Judge Bradfield, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfield presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is July 20th, 2022, for the record. I'm going to ask the marshal to call the first case. We just as a note for everyone, we have five matters on our calendar today. Two of those are oral, and of course, I see the attorneys for the first case are present. So, Marshal, go ahead and call the first case.
Now calling case 822-0049. In the matter of the short call substitute teaching license application of Geronimo Yanez.
All right, and counsel, I see that you're ready and present, and I'll make just a few remarks before we start the arguments today. First of all, we do very much look forward to hearing from the attorneys in this case. As in all of our cases, our conversations are helpful to the court. Before you start your remarks, I just want to remind you that our proceedings are recorded today, and the audio recording becomes available on the court's website later. So my remarks kind of go to that, which is, please, before you start your argument, if you will identify yourself as well as the client you represent. And then keep an eye on the clock. Each side has 15 minutes with 5 minutes, additional minutes for the appellant. If appellant's counsel so chooses, tends to go quickly, and we do look forward to hearing from you. I'll point out that there are actually three podiums in the courtroom. I don't know if you had time to sit and think about this. The main advantage to the center podium, just to point it out to you, is that you can easily see the clock. I will, of course, call it to your attention. I've got the clock in front of me, too. If for some reason you keep going and miss seeing the clock, and it's not a big deal either way. But the two other podiums are there and available for you if you choose, and we just respect your decision in that regard, given the current public health situation. So with that, I will encourage counsel for appellant to begin when you are ready.
Your Honors, may please court, Robert Fowler, representing the realtor Geronimo Yanez, who is present here to observe as well, Your Honor. Your Honors, when an officer is faced with what he or she believes is an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death, it is fundamentally not immoral to want to live and therefore use deadly force to defend yourself. Our laws, surely the morality of that concept is embodied in not only our state's law, but what the Supreme Court has left its imprimatur in Connor v. Graham. So in situations like that, the United States Supreme Court in Connor v. Graham has said that we need to look at the reasonableness of that action as judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on scene rather than with the 20/20 vision of hindsight. That is very important in this case for a number of reasons. The reasonable officer standard is very important because in the case below, there was no subject matter expert on behalf of the board that could speak to that. With all due respect,
but
for
wasn't the record from the criminal trial submitted into the record in this case? So there's the expert report of Mr. Noble.
That's correct, Your Honor. The record below was quite voluminous, several books.
So there is that evidence in the record.
There is, Your Honor. However,
generally, whether Graham v. O'Connor is met is in fact a jury question, correct? I mean, in 1983 cases, and in this case as well.
It is a question, mixed case. Question of fact and law when the Connor v. Graham analysis is applied. So there's the looking at the record as a whole is important, but again, whatever conclusions are drawn must be viewed from a reasonable officer standard. And certainly the witness that was credited the most by the ALJ and the board was Dr. Gothard, who is not a police officer and is not a subject matter expert on any of this. And so basically, part of this case kind of relies on this. Certainly to the criminal standard, a jury found that the shooting was justified. So they looked at both the prosecution and the state's experts and concluded the state had not met that burden of proof. What appellant is relying on here very, very strongly is this is not a situation that, you know, we all learn in law school that civil cases are different than criminal and different standards of proof. This is not a case where, you know, O.J. Simpson's or the family's, you know, estate is suing under a negligence theory. This is the government. This is a government agency making my client prove that he did not commit a crime. Because they went through, at the ALJ hearing, they cited the criminal statute and said, we conclude that you didn't meet that burden. And, you know, basically my client, you know, we all know the presumption of innocence and the fact that, you know, you don't have the burden of proof as a defendant. Well, if the state is saying you committed a crime, essentially, whether that's in a civil hearing or whatnot, it is fundamentally, I think it's against due process, it's against those constitutional principles to say to that person, you must prove you did not commit a crime before our eyes, the government agency. Again, this is not a case of negligence where we're sorting out civil liability. It's the ultimate question is the same. Had the board not undertaken that analysis, we might have a different story, but the board did. And the ALJ specifically cited the criminal statute and went through that analysis and forced my client erroneously to prove that he did not commit a crime, essentially. That's the real nuance to this case. Nowhere in the ALJ's decision was the Graham v. Connor analysis applied.
So can I ask you a question here? So if somebody who's applying for a teaching license rapes somebody, never criminally tried for whatever reason, would that be immoral conduct that could form the basis for denying a teaching license?
The short answer is it could, but there's a lot of nuances with that answer. First, in this case, we have to look at the administrative law that governs burden of proof, and that's 1400.7300 sub 5. It says the party proposing an action has the burden of proof. In this case, the board chose, not my client, to invoke a permissive, not mandatory reason for excluding a license. So they are the ones who concluded he engaged in immoral conduct. They're proposing the action be denied. So by the plain...
I just want to stop you there. I struggle with that description of what the board did. I mean, it's certainly case law backs you up in the sense that immoral conduct is a discretionary decision. But it is clearly laid out as a reason, statutory basis, for denying a license application, right?
It is, Your Honor, but I would
argue... And so that... From the appellate standard, it's really what standard of review do we apply to our review of the board's determination? And I'm struggling to match that up with the argument that you're making.
Right.
Because I don't see how that shifts the burden of proof over to the board.
Well, again, just my plain reading of the administrative statute that governs these kind of hearings is, at the level below, is... that they're the ones who proposed taking the action. They're the ones who concluded.
No, it's not exactly accurate, though, counsel, because Mr. Yanez did apply for this license. He is the applicant, and in most scenarios, and I think I don't see a reason to differentiate this one, the applicant for a license does have the burden of proof. So the board had within its, you know, there's a long list of reasons for which the board can deny its a teaching license application. And they found one in this particular case.
Right. But I understand that, you know, what was cited by the state, the board, was that, well, look at the law examiner statute or look at the different other agencies or quasi licensing, whatever you want to call it, boards that use this. Sure, the overall is you have to submit the application, you have to dot all the I's and cross the T's. But what happened here was a step beyond that, because they took it to their investigative board, they reached a conclusion, and then they sent it back and said, no, we're invoking this permissive. And so basically, to hold otherwise would be that...
Are you suggesting that in other cases, the board does not ask for investigation, where an applicant reveals, for example, I'll just give the example that Judge Siegel just mentioned. So say in response to an application for a teaching license, an applicant reveals that they have been charged or are under investigation for sexual assault. Are you suggesting the board, you know what, I guess help, you fill in the dots for me.
Well, I would say if in a situation, that exact hypothetical, the board obviously is going to do an investigation. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have. But what I'm saying is, if they conclude that you committed some crime, such as rape, it seems antithetical to our general principles that, you know, the foundation of our criminal law and to some extent our civil law is based on, that the applicant has to prove that he didn't commit a crime. That seems wrong to me. And I will say that as a labor practitioner,
well, here's my second problem. Reason I'm doing this, and I apologize for interrupting you, but the time goes quickly. So my second problem with your argument is that you seem to be assuming that the board denied the license because it found that Mr. Yanez was guilty of a crime that he was acquitted of. And that's not how I read the ALJ's decisions. It is different from that. It is, and you started there. It's focused on whether the conduct that the ALJ found based on all of the evidence that was submitted, whether that is immoral conduct.
Well,
so if you'd go back to that
sure.
standard, that would help me as opposed to, it's confusing for me to have you rely on the crime that Mr. Yanez was acquitted of.
Well, Your Honor, if we look at the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations at pages 10 and 11, the specific conclusions of law that the ALJ made and that the board adopted was, number eight, the applicant failed to establish that his use of deadly force against Mr. Castile was objectively reasonable and necessary, which I might add does not properly state the Connor v. Graham standard. But in the second part there.
One more time with where you are in the ALJ's decision.
Sure. In the October 11th, 2021, at pages 10 and 11, it's also page 10 of my brief. It's cut
and
pasted.
Okay, thank you.
So number eight, the finding, conclusion number eight is, applicant failed to establish that his use of deadly force against Castile was objectively reasonable and necessary. And then in the line following, the decision is based on this, Your Honors. Applicant's pretextual stop, so there's one part, the racial profiling, second part, and third part, killing Mr. Castile, which again, you have to read number eight to see where they concluded mm-hmm. that was wrong. So the board did in fact say, you know, in a use of force situation, it's not like a murder case where, you know, you got to prove the defendant shot the person. In an officer-involved shooting, the officer says, yeah, I did shoot the person, but I was legally justified. And the burden shifts so that the state has to prove that he didn't. And anyways, but in this case then, they said, you failed to establish that your shooting was justified. And so they did do that here. This is the entire basis, what I call the three parts of the ALJ's decision and the board's adoption of that. It is those three things, pretextual stop, racial profiling, and the killing of Mr. Castile. And the most important piece of that is the killing of Mr. Castile, obviously. I mean, that's a big piece.
But you are omitting the end of the sentence, constitute immoral conduct. That's the ALJ's reason. I mean, you're right that the preceding sentence certainly does say what you just said it said. But the reasoning focuses on the statutory standard that is allowed for denial of a license, immoral conduct. Is it? I mean, you have other arguments about that standard, and I'm just wondering if you want to go to them.
Yeah.
Because I am, the ALJ's decision does line up in many regards with the statute. So is there a problem with the statute? I mean, you made that argument, and that's what I just want to know if you want to stick with it or if you're abandoning it.
I'll take issue with the statute
because
in layman's terms, if we go by some people are offended as the grounds for immoral conduct, we've got a problem in society. Because right now, you know, somebody wearing a MAGA hat might be offensive to some. I mean, there's how do you narrow this down? And I don't think there's any proof as well. I mean, you know, Dr. Goddard states that the community was deeply offended. I acknowledge some were deeply offended by the killing of Mr. Castile. But I would say a large portion of the population in the community said, we accept the jury's verdicts and we understand what happened. You know, it's an unfortunate situation, but we've moved on. When you have a very loud, vocal minority group setting the stage for immoral conduct.
But is that in the record minority group? I mean, but aside from that, in your void for vagueness argument, you're saying it's an as-applied challenge. What do you mean by that? And then why do you think it's void for vagueness?
Well, I would make two general arguments against the statutory construction as it is. Number one, their immoral conduct is not clearly defined by the statute, so there's been an impromptu saying this is the dictionary definition. And there's several items in that definition, the last of which is offends the morals of the community standard, okay? So that's only one part of it. The rest of it clearly talks about things that are conduct-based and are pretty straightforward. But that last piece is essentially what the ALJ and the board relied on. They said the community was deeply offended, therefore it's immoral. And there's, when I say there's no proof, there was a conclusory statement by Dr. Gothard, and using a settlement of a lawsuit, which we all know from law school is not evidence, there was never a disciplinary proceeding or finding that my client engaged in wrongdoing. And so they reached this conclusion that it was, you know, because there was protesters, it must have been offending the standards of the community. But again, what percentage do we need? So as applied, how do you say that the community is offended? Is it because there's a loud, small group? Or is it because there was a vote? I mean, how do we determine that? You know, basically this would...
That's the part you feel is...
Yes.
Vague, not the word immoral.
I think the phrase in the statute, immoral conduct, is not defined, and that lack of definition does lead to a vagueness issue. But even with the dictionary definition that has been proposed, if you rely solely on this community basis, then, or that the community is offended, that certainly, as applied, is constitutionally vague, because anything could fall. If a community doesn't like you, you don't get a teaching license. I mean, what does that mean? What standards do we apply? How do I know as a citizen what to expect of the government so that you can tell me what my standards are? And I see that I'm out of time. I do have several other arguments, but I will wait for rebuttal.
Is there anything else at this time? Okay. All right, and of course you do, Council, as you noted. You have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, and we will talk more then.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dave Cullen. I'm an assistant attorney general, appearing on behalf of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. As set forth in the record and as determined by the administrative law judge and the board, after an evidentiary hearing, Relator engaged in immoral conduct under Pelsby's licensing standards because he took a life he should not have taken and endangered the lives of others when he shot and killed Philando Castile.
Mr. Yanez was charged with criminally negligent conduct. So to be immoral, does it need to be willful, intentional, or does any kind of negligence that results in somebody's death, does that fit the definition of immoral? And if so, why?
Yes, Your Honor, it can fit the definition of immoral conduct to do something that's negligent with a careless disregard or is not objectively reasonable under the circumstances or is not necessary.
So careless disregard, I mean, reckless? Do you need reckless disregard? I mean, what is the standard and where are you getting it from? And I guess what I'm getting at is this void for vagueness argument.
Well, the ALJ and the board correctly acknowledged, Your Honor, that the term immoral conduct is not defined in Section 122A.20, and the ALJ and the board rely on...
Mr. Cullen, I'm going to ask you to speak into the microphone just a little bit more,
sure.
And maybe... Yeah, and the podium does go up and down, so if you want to make that adjustment, you can, and we'll watch the clock stop at for a moment or add some more time?
The ALJ and the board relied on the same approach courts have used in interpreting this term, immoral conduct, by applying common and approved usage. In doing so, the ALJ and the board properly concluded that immoral conduct means conduct which offends the morals of the community in which it occurred.
Okay, so we're dealing with the morals of the community. So how do you define morals? And when you're applying for, explain when somebody is applying for a statewide license, why would we look to one particular community, since I guess we all recognize that certain things, that there may be variation, at least the courts have recognized there could be variation community to community.
Your Honor, in this case, the record and the evidence in the record was the offensive nature of the conduct issue in the community of Falcon Heights, of St. Paul, of the St. Paul Public Schools, of the Twin Cities, of Minnesota, and indeed nationwide.
But where does the evidence come from for statewide?
The record includes, among other things, a statement by the governor at the time of the state of Minnesota speaking out about the offensive and hurtful nature of the conduct at issue. Nationwide, the record also includes a statement by the president at the time of the United States speaking out about the offensive and hurtful nature of the conduct at issue. And I think the facts are important.
Yeah, just to stop, pause just for a moment. I mean, I recognize the record includes both of those things, this president's statement, the governor's statement, that related specifically to the tragic death of Mr. Castile, right? Those statements did not relate to immoral conduct as contained, and I keep wanting to direct the attorney's attention back to the statute we are being asked to review this board decision under, which is the immoral conduct, Mr. Yanez's application for a teaching license. So, what evidence do you have that that is immoral conduct as it relates to the teaching of students? Now, that, I think, is the expert testimony that was offered, doctor's testimony, and it, as I read it, it seemed to primarily relate to the local community. And local defined fairly large as the Twin Cities, but this is a statewide teaching license. So I just, if you don't mind going back to, you know, Judge Siegel's question and focusing on that.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of points on that. One is that the board's expert, Dr. Gothard, opined, and the ALJ and the board concluded that the conduct at issue negatively impacts relators' ability to uphold the teacher code of ethics. And it is a statewide license that he's applying for, and a substitute teaching license would give the applicant, if granted, the right to walk into any school in any district throughout the state of Minnesota.
But and they'd have to be hired, correct?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. For example, the St. Paul Public Schools uses an agency called Teachers on Call.
So couldn't they tell Teachers on Call, we do not want Mr. Yanez in our schools because it would be terribly upsetting to our students?
I think hypothetically, yes.
I mean, they don't have, well, not hypothetically, I mean, actually.
In reality.
Correct. And there is evidence in the record that he successfully was teaching part-time at another school, albeit a private school.
There's a distinction to be made between a teacher of record, who is the regular full-time classroom teacher, and a substitute teacher. As Dr. Gothard testified and opined, he wouldn't be in a position to create a safety plan for students and staff.
But is the St. Paul School District, if the license was granted, and I honestly don't, I'm not getting at any point, I just want to know the answer because I don't know it. The St. Paul School District doesn't have to accept just anybody they send. They could say, no, we don't want this teacher, and as long as it wasn't for an unlawful reason, like because of their race or religion or something, that then they have control over who walks into their buildings, don't they, even with substitute teachers? Or am I wrong? And I don't want to take up too much of your
time. Respectfully, I think you're wrong about that, Your Honor. Substitute teachers receive calls. They go in, and they check in at the office, and they are directed to the classroom that they're subbing in for, and there typically is not advance notice of who that substitute teacher is going to be.
But are these contractors, though, with the school district to provide substitute teachers?
Pardon?
Are they contractors? I mean, who is this group that then says, yeah, we've got substitute teachers, here you go?
Well, and we're straying a bit from the record, but you know, as I mentioned, for example, Teachers on Call is a contracting agency that districts use.
And is it a private nonprofit then, or what is it?
It's
and I know we're outside the record, and I apologize
to my colleagues
and everybody else. But
it's essentially a part-time temporary agency type of an entity.
Okay, all right. Okay.
For teachers.
Then continue on with your argument.
But I think the facts at issue are really important here. And, you know, the Teacher Code of Ethics includes, among other things, protecting students from harm and ensuring their safety and well-being. It includes disciplining, maintaining discipline in a reasonable manner. It includes teaching in a non-discriminatory manner. And in this case...
So what is the essence of why the board determined that Mr. Yan is engaged in immoral conduct? Is it because they think he's a racist? Because you physically can't trust him around children because he might shoot them? I mean, what is the basis?
The basis is maintaining the standards of the profession of teaching, number one, and number two, protecting school children.
The determinative factor in the board's decision for why they determined this was immoral conduct. I'm sorry for not being clear.
No, thank you, Your Honor. The basis was that Relator took a life that he shouldn't have taken. He killed an innocent person without cause, and he endangered the lives of Mr. Castile's girlfriend in the front passenger seat and her four-year-old daughter in the back seat in a car seat. He came up to this car, which he pulled over because the driver, Mr. Castile...
I'm familiar with the facts. So if somebody is tried for whatever, some kind of manslaughter, and they're acquitted, then they're not able to get a license in the state of Minnesota. I mean, that's basically what you're... I mean, not acquitted, but if the if the board determined that they thought that there wasn't a good reason for this person to have died, then they're disqualified.
Well, in this case, after an evidentiary hearing before an administrative law judge,
I assume that all process would be followed. So if somebody, there's no race element at all. But somebody winds up dead, then the board decides there wasn't a good reason for that person to have died, and it's the fault of the applicant, then they would be denied a license as immoral conduct.
I think it would be a fact-dependent analysis. And in this case, the disciplinary committee of the board looked at the record that was available to it and the submissions of the applicant, and initially made that determination to deny the application. Relator then asked for a contested case hearing, an evidentiary hearing before an administrative law judge for there to be findings of fact, and that's what happened here.
So is this, I mean, are we judging morals kind of by the Ten Commandments then, that thou shalt not kill, or what? I mean, I am troubled by this phrase immoral conduct and how broadly, I mean, generally it seems like it's only been used in connection with some kind of sexual misconduct in the past. So how do we make this? And I do not accept that Fahlgren defined it, because it was not an issue really in Fahlgren. It's a dicta. So what are we to do as a court here in saying, yes, they were right, this is immoral conduct?
Respectfully, I think what the court ought to do is defer to the education, experience, and expertise of the board members appointed because of their background and experience to the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board to make that determination on a case-by-case basis, particularly here after an evidentiary hearing in front of an administrative law judge, a two-day evidentiary hearing with multiple witnesses providing testimony.
But there has to be, well, first of all, there's no particular expertise in judging police conduct and reasonable uses of force. I mean, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you, by the board?
Well, I would agree.
Or the ALJ, quite honestly?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And as you noted before, the record did include the expert reports from the criminal trial.
No, I totally get that. So how is somebody to know when they're applying for a teaching license if the board might decide that it's immoral conduct? I mean, that's really the nub. It's not kind of what happened. You know, we've got the whole criminal transcript, you know, a jury of 12 people found that it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a different standard from preponderance of the evidence. I get that. But morals change over time. And being a gay person was immoral. And actually, in some parts of the country, I think it's still viewed as immoral in certain areas. So it's a slippery concept. So help us out here. What do we do with that?
I think the court ought to look at the rationale, the reasons, the findings, the conclusions of the administrative law judge and the board here. And it was a very detailed record, and it was a very thoughtful analysis by the ALJ and the board. And ultimately, it was about maintaining the standards of the profession, and it was about protecting school children in the state of Minnesota. You're right that the Falgren case did not define immoral conduct, and Shaw, unpublished as it is, albeit, got into that and talked in more detail about common usage and judicially constructed the term immoral conduct, which the board did exactly that. And Shaw, by the way, as the court probably noticed, relied on former Chief Administrative Law Judge George Beck's analysis in the Alton case, where he carefully looked at the term immoral conduct and how it ought to be applied. And I would suggest that the Professional Educator Licensing Standard Board is not alone or unique in having a morality concept or a morality requirement for applicants, not unlike the character and fitness requirement, for example, for lawyers. So I think that the record before the court shows that the administrative law judge and the board took a very careful and deliberate look at the record, closely and carefully examined the conduct at issue, and made the decision based on an appropriate and accurate common usage and judicial construction of the term immoral conduct, and the board respectfully requests
that
this court affirm.
And so it ties somehow or another into the profession of teaching? I mean, what are you saying?
It does tie to the profession of teaching in this case, and the record in the board's order and the ALJ's report.
No, not the record. I'm talking about trying to define immoral conduct. So if you were going to give me a definition, besides the very circular definition of its, you know, community standards of what's moral, how should we understand that phrase?
I think as a school child would, what is right and wrong? And in this case, it was wrong for Relator to come up to this car and within 60 seconds, 5 seconds of being told calmly, sir, I do have a firearm on me, for which Mr. Castile had a permit, fire 7 shots into that vehicle, 5 of which fatally struck Mr. Castile, 1 of which came within inches of his girlfriend in the front seat and 1 came within inches of the 4-year-old in the back seat. So I would suggest to the court that it's how a school child would view it as a matter of what's right and wrong, and this offends the morals of the community in the city of St. Paul, in the Twin Cities, throughout Minnesota, and indeed nationwide, and the record supports that.
Counsel, I recognize that you're out of time, but I'm going to give you some additional time and ask the marshal to add 5 minutes so that get a full 5 minutes. We'll do the same for appellant, so there'll be 10 minutes. I do have another question for you, because I hear you relying very strongly on the powerful evidence that was in the record in this case, and there's every good reason for you to do that, and please know that we have reviewed the record carefully and are well aware of the underlying facts in the case and the great tragedy that this case rests on, okay? Having said that, our concern about the immoral conduct standard is also deep in terms of understanding it. And you, I am continue to be troubled despite your argument because you continue to rest your argument on the evidence instead of telling me how does an applicant for a teaching license know what the immoral conduct standard is in making their application. You said just now, you said based on, you know, what a student would think was right and wrong. Well, that's just not a very specific standard at all in my mind. If I look at the statute, which, as I said, you know, does give immoral character or conduct as a reason for denial of a teaching license, undefined, as you noted, the very next section of that statute does talk about specific types of convictions for which an applicant's license may be denied. And all of those, and Judge Siegel alluded to it earlier, all or most of them relate to things such as child abuse or some sort of sexual misconduct. And don't mention crimes of violence at all, apart from as we see them in those contexts, sexual crimes or child abuse, but not generally violent conduct. So help me out. You know, when is the board going to look at overall, you know, conduct, right and wrong, when it applies the immoral character or conduct standard? And when is it going to be more narrowly confined to what the statute has identified, what the legislature identified in the statute?
Well, here, Your Honor, the board's application included a question of the applicant of whether or not they had been charged, convicted, or acquitted of a crime involving, among other things, violence. And so that is a criteria on the application that's important to the board as to whether or not the applicant engaged in, whether charged, convicted, or acquitted of a crime involving violence. So that is relevant, that is germane to the profession of teaching.
Isn't it the fact that somebody was charged with a crime, doesn't that, there's a racially disparate impact from that? So I assume you guys don't rely on that.
No, the board doesn't rely on the mere fact of a charge of a crime. But the idea is to ask the applicant to disclose conduct that was or could be deemed criminal in nature, and that's what happened here. The conduct at issue, there were no findings by the jury in the criminal matter. And here, the applicant asked for an evidentiary hearing so that a specific look at this specific case on these specific facts could be developed. And so that's what happened here. The applicant asked for a contested case. The applicant asked for an evidentiary hearing and got the due process to which he was entitled to. And he may not and doesn't agree with the decision, but the fact of the matter is he was teaching in a private school without a license before this case, and, you know, he can make his decisions as to whether or not he wants to teach in a private school, but the board has a duty to protect the health, safety, and well-being of school children throughout the state of Minnesota, and that's what they did here. I agree, Your Honor, that the standard for statutory review of this court is de novo. The board also cited in its brief the St. Otto Home case, which cited in turn the U.S. Supreme Court of Chevron, that if there's a particular statutory scheme at issue, which there is here under 122A.20, that agency or board is specifically delegated and entrusted to enforce, then some deference should be given by the reviewing court to that agency or board and how they construe and apply the statute. And here, the board did what's been done for decades, going back to Chief Administrative Law Judge George Beck.
But Vaughan, I thought you were relying on dictionary definitions of what the phrase means. So there's no particular expertise in that. I could see impact on students. Anyway, okay, I'm fine.
Anything further, counsel? Did you want to wrap
no,
up?
No, Your Honor. Again, okay. Thank you for your time and the board.
No, and I do. I mean, as the, our presiding judge said, I mean, this is a very, the underlying facts are tragic, and we're not debating that in this courtroom.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. So, counsel, for appellant, you should note it, that we have given you 10 minutes for rebuttal, so wanting to keep the timing as even as possible.
And, Your Honors, I very much appreciate that. Yeah. This is a case with a lot of impact. Not only, you know, are we looking at something that's greater than one district, it is a statewide. It is how the future of the board, you know, will potentially look at how they judge if something's immoral or not. It also affects the profession of policing. I mean, the concern that applicant has is how does his perhaps poor job performance as a police officer, which we might equate with like negligence is what they're alleging, you should have done this, you should have done this, you should have done that, versus is that immoral conduct? The problem here is, would any police officer who's been found not guilty of a justified shooting, will he be able to get a law license? Will he be able to get a teaching license, a haircut license? I mean, you name it. This is a bigger, broader case. And so I do appreciate the extra time because I think it warrants it. So in my closing part here, let's hypothetically say that the board is right, you have the burden of proof, which I don't agree with, but let's say that they did. Isn't the best evidence the fact that my client is already doing the job to great satisfaction, according to his employer who testified in the record, that he has minority students in the school? Nobody's ever complained that you shot somebody.
But you could apply that to the rapist scenario as well. You know, I mean, there are some, I think, the board is saying there are some acts, you know, where you recklessly take somebody's life and you endanger a child and another passenger.
I certainly agree with you, Your Honor, I'm shorter than Mr. Cullen. I certainly agree with you that there are some things that are clearly across the line. And that's why, as Your Honor pointed out, the statute talks about the specifics. And, you know, statutory construction, when you list specific things that you can't do, that should give you guidance in the general, okay? So when it's, you know, with the immoral conduct, you should look to the entire statute. And if we're saying these type of things are clearly violative of, you know, the safety of children because sexual assault clearly falls into that, child abuse clearly falls into that, those things then should give you guidance in interpreting. This is a policeman who, you know, in a very short period of time, as Connor V. Graham talked about, and there's a whole line of police cases that tell, you know, jurors, tell jury members, you have to look at this not from the armchair quarterback position, but you have to look at this as an officer who was there, who thought he was going to die and took certain actions.
Well, I think they did. I mean, they did. So I'm not persuaded by your argument on that issue.
Well, I'll certainly move on then. However, I think when you look at the record, there's a lot of places in the decision that they seem to cherry pick facts. You know, there's this and not this. They completely ignored my client's statement saying race was not the factor here, that I took this robbery report. He looked like the guy. And that was only one of many factors. You know, and I think at one point my client even said, I have a wide set nose. I'm just describing a physical feature. I mean, I hope we're not at the point where, you know, just because of the color of your skin, you can't engage in physical descriptors or form a mental impression and then be labeled a racist. And I think it's really rich that my client, being a racial minority who's experienced real racism, is being labeled a racist by folks who don't share his color of skin. I mean, it's...
So, counsel, let me just ask you for a moment. It is certainly true that some of the evidence that you've just described was offered and submitted in this case and heard by the ALJ. Nonetheless, the ALJ, having heard conflicting evidence, made some very damaging findings about Mr. Yanez and his racism, all right?
I understand the judge made those, but I'm not sure how much deference we should give to those in light of the entire
record. Give me a legal reason. Not that you disagree with how the ALJ weighed the evidence, because we won't do that. That is not the role of the appellate court to reweigh the evidence that the ALJ heard. Give me a legal reason for that.
Right. Well, the legal reason is it has to be supported by substantial evidence, and when there's a lot of things ignored that were clearly in favor, it does lead someone to wonder, how objective was that decision? We know this is a great tragedy, but that's the point here is that police officers sometimes have cases, I've had them many times in my 23-year career representing the police, where there's a tragic outcome, but the law was followed. And in this case, even the pretextual issue, which is one of the three main reasons that the ALJ and the board adopted, they said it was a pretextual stop. What does that mean? He had a taillight out. That's lawful, and under the Wren analysis, which Supreme Court's put its imprimatur on, as long as you have a valid reason, it's frankly, it's good police work to suspect maybe this might be the person since he's the one who took the report. He saw the video. We'll never know anything further, and we don't need to go there. But, you know, basically the board is saying, you took a life that you shouldn't have taken. Yes, in hindsight, we all know that. But what did he know at that time? And that's what the ALJ and the board did not look at is, from the perspective of a reasonable officer. To get back to one of your questions, Your Honor, is, you know, couldn't you say that about the rapist? Yes, you could. But where it doesn't relate to the job at hand, his former career as a police officer and maybe his, what could be argued by the family as negligence and maybe the basis for a civil suit, et cetera. How is that immoral conduct versus, you know, a human being, because officers are not superhuman, they make mistakes. How is that immoral conduct? I just don't see the overriding fact that it would be.
But you could argue that there was this child in the back seat, and Mr. Yanez was valuing his own life over the life of that child. I mean, that, you know, that would be a moral judgment.
But
right?
that moral judgment is embodied in our law to give the police officer the right to use deadly force if he feels his life is endangered. That's our state standard
not
that we've had for.
Not to endanger the lives of others.
Does it mean the officer should?
I mean, it's to protect and to serve, I think.
Well, and I'm very passionate about this, Your Honor.
Okay, way off.
No, but I'm very passionate about this because I spent a career representing cops and doing this work. If you were faced with what you believe is an imminent threat of deadly force, you know, the officer doesn't have to choose to give up their life because there's somebody there. It is not the standard of law at all. It is, and you have to make these decisions in a split second. And that's why I'm saying, when both of your honors ask, well, where's the intent? Or is it reckless? Is it negligent? Those are issues with the past job performance that doesn't relate to children. It relates to his role as police officer. And police officer has to make this decision in split seconds. I mean, these things happen fast. If he thought that a gun was coming out, he has to act. And it doesn't give you the luxury of this great, you know, what you should have done that the board said he should have done differently. How is that immoral? And that's the real difficulty I have with the case is, you know, you're saying you could never teach a child because you made this split-second decision without any run-up or evidence as to my client's overt racism or this other stuff, which he doesn't have. But, you know, there's just not that element there. Don't you think, Your Honors, if that had been present in this case, the jury would have convicted him? If they thought that there was really this, you know, out to get the African-American person or just disregard of rights, that don't you think the jury would have weighed that in their decision? Because I know juries follow, you know, jury instructions, but they also have common sense, and they also make those decisions.
There is, counsel, though, a secondary decision that's made. It's not just the jury's decision to acquit Mr. Yanez, but we are faced here with an ALJ's determination adopted by the board that Mr. Yanez, for instance, in this conduct, that what he did was indicative of racial bias, microaggressions, negativity bias, that would be detrimental to students. So if you'd respond to counsel's argument asking us to focus not just on what happened in the tragic death of Mr. Castile, but also how that behavior as found by the ALJ. So not, we're going back to the jury's determination on the defense that was offered by Mr. Yanez, but as found by the ALJ, how that impacts the ability to teach, because that's the finding that we have to grapple with in light of the statutory standard.
Right. And Your Honor, I just would say it has to be supported by substantial evidence, and I don't believe this issues of race, et cetera, was, and the profiling was supported.
But is it but, substantial evidence? I mean, we are dealing with arbitrary and capricious standard of review. And so it's really, is there support in the record? It's not substantial evidence, is it? Or if it is, what's your legal authority for that?
I'm running really low on time, so I want to say this. In the early stages of my brief in the legal standard, I set out the standard there. So it is there, but I don't want to. What I do want to do is answer your question, is the difference between potential issues of potential future job performance does not equate to immoral conduct. I mean, so sure, the board has raised an issue. Could the students in St. Paul Public Schools feel that they would be negatively impacted by somebody who's involved in a high-profile issue teaching them? Sure, that's an issue of potential job conduct, not immoral conduct. And the final point to answer your question, Your Honor, is I think it's a bit presumptuous that my client has been shown to teach perfectly well in a private school, but it's so vastly different in a public school setting that he can't. And again, if even hypothetically say, if we have the burden of proof, that testimony from his employer should have been very compelling. He's doing a great job. And this doesn't relate to immoral conduct in the ability to teach students from a potentially, maybe even admittedly, poorly performed job as a police officer that could equate to negligence. But again, these potential issues of employment, that's not equating to immoral conduct. And that's what's really important. How does he know, how do we know what the immoral conduct standard is? And that's the real gist of the case from my perspective, plus those other reasons in the brief. And, you know, I do appreciate the extra time, and I see that I'm out of time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate the arguments that we heard today, as well as the briefs. And yes, we have read the briefs, and all of your arguments are captured there, and we will take those under consideration. So this matter is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory framework. So thank you, counsel.